This is How Sound, the backstory to great radio storytelling. How Sound comes to you from PRX and Transom. I'm Rob Rosenthal. Gabriella Emanuel is a reporter at WGBH in Boston, and one day, her editor pitched her a story idea.
Oh, I was instantly intrigued.
Basically, the editor, his name is Sean Corcoran, by the way, Sean said he'd heard a rumor many years ago when he lived on Cape Cod. And the rumor was about a race-related incident on the Cape that took place in the early 1960s. He asked around for more info at the time, but he couldn't verify anything, so he just dropped it. Well, fast forward to April of 2019, and Sean heard President Trump talking about sending immigrants to sanctuary cities.
California certainly is always saying, oh, we want more people, and they want more people in their sanctuary cities. Well, we'll give them more people. We can give them a lot. We can give them an unlimited supply. And let's see if they're so happy. They say we have open arms. They're always saying they have open arms. Let's see if they have open arms.
Statements like that from the president got Sean thinking about the rumor again, where something similar to what the president was talking about happened on Cape Cod. This time, Sean dug a little deeper, found out the rumor was true, and he asked Gabriella if she would look into it further.
And had you heard anything about it before?
Oh, no, no, no. Not only had I not heard about it, I went to experts who cover race and ethnicity here at GBH, at NPR. None of them had heard about it. I reached out to several of my friends who are historians, they're professors of history, and they hadn't heard about it. So I don't think it was entirely unknown on Cape Cod and in a few little pockets in the U.S., but it has been largely forgotten.
Gabriella's online research into this incident started with Wikipedia. She found only a few paragraphs.
But as soon as I typed it into newspaper archives, 500, maybe more, articles popped up immediately. And many of them were front page stories. They all happened during 1962. And from there, I started piecing together what had happened. And this is not an uplifting story. It's not a story we can tell proudly.
Gabriella discovered so much information that she produced a two-part series on the topic called The Long Journey North, The Forgotten Story of the Reverse Freedom Riders. Here's an excerpt from the opening to the first story.
This is WGBH's Morning Edition. The Freedom Rides in the early 1960s were a monumental event in the civil rights movement when black and white activists traveled through the South, their goal to integrate Greyhound buses. But what came the next summer has largely been forgotten, when Southern segregationists retaliated with the reverse Freedom Rides. They were even considered by some to be an urban legend. But WGBH News has spent several months digging through archives, finding reels of old TV footage, and locating those in Massachusetts whose lives were defined by it. WGBH Radio's Gabriella Emanuel has the first of a two-part series on the reverse Freedom Rides.
In 1962, late on a Wednesday afternoon, a Greyhound bus arrived in Hyannis, Massachusetts. The doors open at the bus stop closest to the Kennedy compound. Lila Mae Williams and her nine youngest children stepped onto the pavement. Silent TV footage captured the moment. In the recording, Lila Mae looks immaculate despite a three-day journey from Arkansas. She's wearing a black shiny dress, a triple string of pearls, white high heels. She is dressed to meet the Kennedys.
She had been promised she was going to the Kennedys, where the Kennedys lived at. She was going to have a job and she was going to be able to support her family.
It was all a scam, all a hoax, and it was just embarrassed the Kennedys, embarrassed the president.
Mickey and Betty Williams are two of Lila Mae's children. Now in their 60s and 70s and living in the Boston area, they were 5 and 18 when the family became reverse Freedom Riders. They were convinced or tricked by white segregationists into boarding a northbound bus.
When they put us on that bus and they brought us to the Kennedy compound, they was almost saying to the Kennedys, here you go, here's, you know, calling them, you know, niggas, you know, here you go, here they are.
The Kennedys were not there to welcome the Williams family. There was no permanent housing, as had been promised, no jobs. In 1962, Lila Mae Williams and about 200 other African Americans were simply dropped in northern cities. They were pawns in a segregationist game.
That's a clip from the first of two stories on reverse freedom riders, and I want to stop the piece there for a moment. How Gabriella found characters like the Williams for the story is pretty fascinating.
because it happened so long ago, I needed this very kind of narrow window of people, people who had come over as children and would still be alive, but were old enough to remember what had happened.
Gabriella's first step was to create a database. She entered all the names she found in the newspaper articles.
And I started sifting through records, marriage records, voting records, death records, obituaries, seeing who had siblings and where those siblings lived. I was just like building almost like a complex family tree of everyone who'd been on those buses.
Some of the people she discovered lived in the Boston area, so she went out and knocked on doors. That didn't work. People didn't answer. She tried calling. That didn't work either.
And I ended up writing handwritten letters, and I personalized. I told these people about the newspaper articles I'd read about them, and I asked if they'd be willing to talk with me.
You hand wrote the letter.
Yeah, I wanted it not to feel like it was a form letter. I wanted it to feel like I was a person behind the note. I had thought about them and their family, and one person asking another person, not kind of, you know, coming from a big organization asking for something.
Gabriella says it took many months to find people and many more months to convince them to talk. Like Betty Williams, who we heard from in the opening scene of Gabriella's story. Betty answered Gabriella's letter, but not with a, yes, I'd like to be interviewed. Instead, she first wanted to learn more about Reverse Freedom Riders before she shared anything.
I ended up meeting with her, I don't know, half dozen times, and talking with her son and her daughter-in-law and kind of sharing with them a lot of the old newspapers I'd found, reading it together with them. And I think part of what was significant for her is that the family had remembered their history such that they were freedom riders and not reverse freedom riders. So they'd retold their family history with themselves as the heroic activists, not the victims of a racist plot. And I think partially processing that and kind of realizing their own history, it took its own time, and she needed to process that before she was willing to share her experience.
As for the racist plot Gabriella referred to, here's another clip from the first story.
It all started the year before, when segregationists like Ned Touchstone were incensed by the Freedom Rides.
Sending down busloads of people here with express purpose of violating our laws, fomenting confusion, trying to destroy 100 years of workable tradition and good relations between the races.
Touchstone joined George Singelman and others in answering the Freedom Rides with the Reverse Freedom Rides. They'd use the same weapon, the Greyhound bus, and send African Americans north. Then they'd see if the North liked it when blacks were in their backyard.
The ultimate accomplishment, of course, is to focus attention on the hypocrisy of the Northern liberals.
The ploy to expose the North's racism grabbed headlines around the world, and Singelman was often on TV.
They have been crying the sing-song in behalf of the Negroes throughout the nation. And, of course, now when it comes time for them to put up or shut up, they have shut up.
Singelman orchestrated the Reverse Freedom Rides through local segregationist groups called Citizens Councils. They were basically
the Ku Klux Klan without the hoods and the masks.
Clive Webb is at the University of Sussex in England. He says he's the type of historian who wants to wash his hands after he's been in the archives. He specializes in studying racists. He says the Citizens Councils attempted to cloak segregation in respectability.
They could be members of the police force, they could be bankers, businessmen, and their like.
Local chapters bought bus tickets and fanned out across the South to enlist black riders.
They targeted people who were either welfare recipients or prison inmates, people who were placing a burden, as they saw it, on public resources.
The vision had been to send thousands north, but the reality was far smaller. Several hundred African Americans, mostly from Arkansas and Louisiana, accepted the northbound tickets. They went to New York, New Hampshire, Los Angeles, Idaho, the list goes on. The largest number, nearly 100, went to the Kennedys' summer White House in Hyannisport.
To fully report this story, Gabriella combed through archives at Tulane University, Harvard, and the Rhode Island Historical Society. The film and audio clips used in the story were analog and had to be digitized. In one case, Gabriella met a family member connected to the story who had saved a huge box of newspaper clippings and photos. The collection also included letters, hateful letters, written to the woman's father who had helped the Reverse Freedom Riders when they arrived on Cape Cod. Gabriella says there was a great deal of discussion in the newsroom about whether to publish the letters online. They decided no.
It ended up being just that those letters were just too extreme, too awful. And I think we spoke to several different people of color here in the newsroom about kind of what would be the most appropriate way to include or not include that information. And the consensus was clear by the end of our conversation that it just wasn't worth including.
The second story Gabriella produced focused on the local response to the arrival of Reverse Freedom Riders, about how religious leaders and members of the NAACP and others teamed up to provide food and housing. Toward the end of the two-part series, Gabriella connected the story to the present day.
Historian Clive Webb of the University of Sussex in England says for him, some of today's politics are reminiscent of the Reverse Freedom Rides.
In 1962, what was happening was the actions of a political fringe group. And in 2019, it's the federal government.
Mr. President, yeah, tell us your plans about sanctuary cities and illegal migrants that you tweeted about.
Well, you know, the
President Trump's idea of putting undocumented immigrants on buses and dropping them off in so-called sanctuary cities made Webb think back to segregationists like Amos Guthridge in 1962.
They want more people in their sanctuary cities? Well, we'll give them more people. We can give them a lot. We can give them an unlimited supply.
We're going to find out if people like Mr. Ted Kennedy and the Kennedys, all of them, really do have an interest in the Negro people, really do have a love for the Negro, and a desire to help him.
And let's see if they're so happy. They say we have open arms. They're always saying they have open arms. Let's see if they have open arms.
While there's not evidence the Trump administration has enacted the policy, the president told a rally in Green Bay, Wisconsin, that he was implementing the plan.
I'm proud to tell you that was actually my sick idea, but so is it.
When you look at the end of the story where we tie it to Trump, this was something that Clive Webb, the historian I spoke to from the UK, did explicitly himself. He said he was listening to the news and he paused and he said he almost cut his finger with the kitchen knife because it was so striking. And when I was first introduced to the topic, it had been framed around Trump had this proposal. I heard rumors that maybe something similar happened. Can you try and track it down? And that's where it started. But then when we were in the editing process, I really debated whether to link it to the kind of present day. And my editor and I went back and forth many times. I was worried it would really color how listeners heard about this historic event and bring kind of the polarization that we see right now in our country to this history that I didn't think needed to be polarized. But my editor, as you know, this story has it in there, and he thought it was really important to kind of, it's at least for me, it's a moment in the story where you're like, you connect all the dots. Anything that might have been implicit in what was happening and parallels to today, because the language of the segregationist then is so similar to what you hear today, it becomes very powerful, and he didn't want to lose that power.
One way to think about that piece of tape where you go back and forth between a segregationist and Donald Trump's words, I almost wonder if that's the why now for the story. And yet it comes at the very end of the two-part series.
Yes, that's a reflection of the debate my editor and I had. He, his instinct initially was he wanted it up front. He wanted it maybe even in the introduction to the piece. He wanted to at least hint at it very early on. And I was nervous that that was going to color the way everyone listened to this piece of history and these people's stories that they had been very reluctant to share. And I wanted the listeners to take it at face value that these people's stories without bringing all their kind of political feelings and polarization that you might see today with them into the story.
Will there be a third feature to go with the first two? Gabriella says she doesn't know, but she's still filing FOIAs, Freedom of Information Act requests. And the day we talked, she had just received a file from the Justice Department about reverse freedom riders.
Even though the story's all done, I still have questions. So I think anyone who has questions will just keep going.
Have you listened to the story posted on Transom not too long ago? It's called Not in the Cards. Vivian Schutz produced it, and she says she typically plans a story before she starts reporting. She has a sense of the plot and the stakes and the bigger picture, but for Not in the Cards, she knew none of that, and the result is quite captivating. You should listen to Not in the Cards. It's at transom.org. And speaking of listening to things, I'm not a huge fan of audio fiction, but Passenger List is an exception, a big one. Passenger List is a Radiotopia podcast about an airline flight that disappears between London and New York. And I'm not going to tell you anything more. Well, other than Kelly Marie Tran is in it. Have a listen. Passenger List from Radiotopia. This is How Sound, the backstory to great radio storytelling. It's a production of PRX and Transom. Thanks to John Barth and to WCAI in Woods Hole. I'm Rob Rosenthal. Thanks for listening.